Hello and welcome to these Warwick podcasts. I'm currently joined by Martin Wolf, the Associate Editor and Chief Economics Correspondent of the Financial Times. During the 70s, Martin worked as an economist at the World Bank and in 1981 joined the London-based Trade Policy Research Centre as Director of Studies, before joining the Financial Times in 1987. He is the author of several books and numerous articles on global economics and political economy. He has won numerous awards for his journalism and in 2000 was awarded the CBE for his services to financial journalism. Okay, so congratulations on your honorary degree. How does it make you feel?
Well, it's an honour, and it's very pleasant, I suppose, not least because one actually hasn't had to do any work for it, and it feels very different. It feels different from all other degrees one has got in the past, and that sort of feels a bit as though it's a cheat, because everybody else has done so much work. But it is a great honour, and it's very pleasant.
You may be aware that the Warwick Commission are currently looking at international financial architecture. And you are well known for kind of pointing out that the crisis was looming, so to speak. I wondered what kind of regulatory reform you would recommend, if indeed any at all.
Well, clearly there's going to have to be regulatory reform. I don't think there's any doubt about it. The first point is it's going to be very difficult. Any regulatory reform has got to deal with some huge systemic issues, and it has to be global. It's really very, very hard to do this, and really impossible at a national level, given that the financial system remains globalized. And so, in practice, I fear not very much is going to be done. The things I've focused on in my analysis is the underlying incentives for the financial system. And I've argued that the financial system's incentives are extremely defective for a host of reasons, which are probably impossible to go through now. But what we need to do is to consider how far we can alter those incentives. And I think we can do so in a number of ways, the most important of which are enormously to increase the capital, the equity in the financial system, and to change remuneration structures within the system. I think those are the two most important things. In addition, we're going to have to look at liquidity and amount of liquidity that companies hold. We're going to have to look at transparency so people can actually assess the conditions of the companies. That means completely consolidated accounts, and it means all derivatives which are traded in any large volume should, in my view, be traded on exchanges, which makes them safer and more transparent. So I see what we have to do is a combination of fundamental changes in incentives, and fundamental changes in transparency, and a particularly important respect of aspect of the incentives is doing something about the so-called too big to fail problem, which is where we unfortunately are now.
You just mentioned about too big to fail and transparency, and in one of your latest comment pieces you said that Mervyn King of the Bank of England should have a voice. Do you think in the kind of digital world this could be something that could be to his advantage?
Well, in whatever world, it seems to me that the final say on systemic stability should probably rest with the central bank, at least in our structure where we have three institutions, the Treasury, the Financial Services Authority, and the Bank of England. It seems to me pretty clear the bank is the only institution that's charged with looking at the economy as a whole on a regular basis. So I tend to think the systemic stability issues should ultimately rest with the bank. Now, it will have a voice. The proposals of the government clearly give the bank a significant voice. But it's not just a question of voice. It's a question of the final say. And as I understand the proposals, the final say would seem to rest with the FSA, which I don't think is right. Now, I don't think the communications technology of our age changes this fundamental requirement, which is one of just institutional clarity and the clarity of responsibility, which we really haven't had in this crisis.
What role do you see for new communications technology in financial journalism itself?
Well, I think the big answer is the new communications technology is transforming all of journalism, and this because it's transforming the economics of communication so radically. And I'm not convinced that financial and business journalism is more affected than any other branch of journalism. They're all affected in different ways. Now, it is true that one of the consequences, which has been very important for us, is the collapsing of the distinction between the old wire services and the news organizations like ours. And these are basically, we're becoming more like a wire service with the posting things constantly on the website, and they, the wire services, are becoming more like us. They're communicating directly with the public. So that's one very, very important transformation. A second really big transformation is that television stations and news organizations like ours are also converging. We produce an enormous amount of video output now on our website. They, of course, do, the television stations do the same thing. So again, we're converging. What I think is left at the end of this is that so the means we use are all increasingly the same, and we're all overlapping increasingly. In the end, success has to come from producing first-rate content and persuading people that they want to use this content, they trust the content, and in one way or another, they're prepared to pay for it. At the moment, the big problem is the latter. Nobody is prepared to pay for this. So all the models are uneconomic. It's not clear, therefore, how the sort of journalism we do is going to survive in the marketplace.
Today we saw Ed Miliband make a statement to the House of Commons about moving towards a low-carbon industry. Do you think enough is being done to take opportunity of the current crisis, so to speak, to move towards a green economy?
I think that's a very difficult question to answer. Because my view tends to be that you should, very much an economist's response, you should keep things separate. So there's a very strong long-run case, I think, for moving in the direction of a low-carbon economy. It can't be done quickly. It's a very long-term process. It's going to be very difficult and costly. And we should continue to do that, whatever the economic cycle is. The economic events are, I think, by those standards, short-term. You know, might be a few years, but we're not talking about 100 years, not a long-term process of transformation. And we have to respond to the economic crisis as best we can, get the economy on an even keel. Now, I think it's probably true that if we do the first thing well, that will generate some opportunities. I have no idea how big those opportunities will be. But I do think that analytically, we should try and treat these as separate developments, and deal with one in the time horizon that's appropriate for that, the carbon change we need, and deal with the other, the crisis, more urgently, or at least immediately, because it's what confronts us.